Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the third of these lectures. We've already had two absolutely fascinating exposés. We've been told that we're inconsistent, ignorant about ourselves. But the most fascinating thing is that there is a physical correlate, a straightforward physical correlate of happiness, which is the difference between electrical activity here and here. Now, the difference has been very high in the previous two lectures, I would say, both between here and here. And there must have been a lot of activity somewhere else, I think, where we were actually challenged to think rather than just feel. We're really looking forward to the third of these lectures, which will bring the argument to a climax.
The talk today returns to the topic of the first lecture, and actually I think in terms of the topic itself, there is less emotion than there was in yesterday's talk. We're coming back, I propose, to the topic of bounded rationality. I mentioned in the first lecture that psychologists tend to think in lists, and it was a major struggle for me not to show you my whole list, the list of all the ways in which the human agent as viewed by psychologists differs from the stock and very simple and in many ways extraordinarily elegant model that Frey summarized with those three assumptions that people are rational, selfish, and have unchanging tastes. So instead of showing you the entire list, I'm going to do something slightly different but not very much more satisfactory. I'm going to pick, I have picked, pretty much arbitrarily, two items from the list. Two items that in some way specify or help specify the ways in which rationality is bounded. And those are also two ideas, two psychological ideas that I think, I'm not entirely sure, but I believe may have some potential for insertion into economic models. That is, they may actually turn out to be pieces of the human agent that one can modify within the economic model, and that may have some consequences. And for both of these stories, indeed, there are already some beginnings of implications and applications, which I will mention in passing. And I will, the two topics that I'll talk about today, and they're fairly discrete, although they're joined by, as you'll see, there is a psychological idea that runs through both of them. I label them the power of the particular and the power of defaults. And I will start by talking about the power of the particular and by two possible views of a planning problem. And I will start by a personal story, which is by now very, very old, I think, well over 20 years. When I was teaching at Hebrew University and already working on these things, mainly on problems of judgment under uncertainty, the idea came up of writing a book that would serve to instruct high school students in the art of judgment and decision making under uncertainty without appealing to formal mathematics at all. And so we had a grant from the Ministry of Education, we put a group together, and there were about eight or 10 of us working on that topic. I had several assistants. The dean of the School of Education was a member of the team. There were practicing teachers. And we were having quite a good time. We would meet normally once a week and then, you know, work in between. And the incident that I will describe occurred when, we must have been working about a year or a year and a half. And on one of these Friday meetings, I don't really know what possessed me on that particular day, but I had the thought of trying to figure out, you know, forecast our future. And the way to do this, actually, if you want to run a forecasting exercise of this kind, is not to have an open discussion because people far too quickly converge to a common answer. So I ran it in a slightly different way. I asked everyone in the group to try to think about the following question. How long will it take us to complete a draft of the book and this is to be defined very precisely, a draft of a book that we are prepared to deliver to the Ministry of Education. When do we think this is going to happen? And I asked everyone to write down their answer on a slip of paper, and I wrote my answer on a slip of paper, and then we collected them all. And there was a lot of unanimity among us. The whole range of answers was contained between 18 months and 30 months. And before we started discussing this, I had another idea. I had lots of ideas that morning. I had another idea, which was to ask the dean of the School of Education about his opinion. But I asked him his opinion in an unusual way. I already knew his opinion because he had written on a slip of paper, and his prediction was that we'd be finished in 2 years. But I turned to him and I asked him whether he knew of other cases like ours, and defined as a group trying to write a curriculum on a topic where no curriculum has existed before. So, and he thought, and actually he could think of several examples, some in biology, some in some areas of new areas of mathematics or logic. And then I asked him, well, can you, if you know enough about these groups, this happened to be his topic, curriculum development was his topic, if you know enough about these groups, could you locate us, or locate each of these groups, at a point in their progress towards completing their mission that is similar to what we have already achieved? And he said, yes, I probably can do that. And I said, well, how long did it take them to reach their goal? And he thought for a few minutes, and you know, this for me has now become a legend, so in my legend he blushed, but he should have blushed. He said, you know, I notice as I think about it that, well, something very odd. I noticed that not all of them ever finished the book. In fact, about 40% just never made it. They quit. And then I said, you know, very eagerly, and how about those who did finish, you know, how long did it take them? Well, he said, I cannot think of any group that took less than 7 years. And I cannot think of any group that lasted for more than 10 before giving up. And 7 to 10 is where all my examples are, except those that gave up earlier. By that time, there was considerable anxiety, I think, building up. And so I had another thought. And I asked him, well, you know, if you compare us to the other groups in terms of our resources and, you know, what we bring to the completion of our mission, how would you describe us? And he thought a while and he said, well, a little below average. Now, this is a true story. It was for us. I can tell you several things about this incident because this actually was a formative incident in my intellectual life. We should have quit. I'm absolutely convinced that the rational thing to do that morning, right then and there, would have been to say, this isn't worth it. None of us was prepared to spend 7 to 10 years on that project. We didn't quit. That was the end of rational planning for that organization. There was a book. It appeared 8 years later. I had left Israel by then. The book, I think, was essentially worthless. Nobody ever used it. It was a completely worthless undertaking. The importance of the story as a psychological story is to analyze a bit what happened in the head, or what was happening in the head of the dean of education that morning. Because notice that what he seems to have brought to bear in response to the two questions, how long will it take us, 24 months? How long does it take groups like us, 40% fail, and between 7 and 10 years if they succeed? It turns out there are two ways of looking at this problem, and there are two ways of looking at many problems. And I would call one of them the inside view. We have called one of them the inside view, and the other the outside view of a problem. The inside view is what happens when you focus on the specifics of the problem at hand. So when you're trying to develop a particular scenario and you have a plan and then you make adjustments for that plan and for what might go wrong, the outside view is when you abstract from the individual case and you try to look at the individual problem as an instance of a broader category about which you may have formally or informally some statistical knowledge. In this instance, we had an individual in whose head was everything required to take the inside view or to take the outside view. And there are two things that I'd like to mention here. First, there was no connection. That is, obviously, in his first approach, like all the rest of us, he took what I would call the inside view. As he was trying to extrapolate from what we had accomplished, figure out a rate at which we were producing chapters, then making a sensible adjustment for, the kind of thing that people do when they make plans. In many instances, it turns out, we encounter this type of contrast between the inside view and the outside view. And it turns out that in general, especially in difficult problems of this kind, the advice would be unequivocal. Take the outside view, if you can. And if you cannot, you are probably in trouble and your forecasts are much too optimistic, or if you have a plan, then your forecasts are much too close to your plan, very likely. If you take the outside view, you're likely to be at least in the ballpark. If you take the inside view, as was the case, you know, in the story that I'm telling you, you may not even be close to the correct answer. So, the psychology indicates here that the outside view, I think, is very likely to be more accurate in many cases. By the way, you can quite often take more than one outside view to the same problem. That is, a given forecasting problem is a member of many categories, and you can try it as a member of many categories. You can triangulate. It is a worthwhile exercise to find out the units that allow comparisons across problems that may be different. So a book by a given author might be compared to books by the same author or to books of the same type. There are more than one. There are different ways of looking at this. But the important point for the purpose of the lecture today is that this story illustrates, I believe, the power of the particular. It illustrates our preferred tendency to think about problems that we have, say forecasting problems, in terms of their specifics, and not to think of problems, not to take the broad view or the outside view of problems. What we were exhibiting that day has a technical name. It's called the planning fallacy, and it is endemic in both private and public affairs. And from my colleague in psychology, Dale Griffin, who teaches at Sussex and is here, I learned that the canonical example of the planning fallacy is the Sydney Opera House, which in 1957, the estimate was that it would be completed in 1963 and would cost $7 million. It was completed, a scaled-down version, Dale writes, was completed in 1973 at a cost of $102 million. But this is not only that particular story. We have, and I mentioned that in the first lecture when I was discussing risk-taking, I was saying that there is endemic entrepreneurial optimism, and this has been documented too. There was a study by Cooper and Wu, I believe, published in 1988, where they interviewed entrepreneurs, but small-scale entrepreneurs, people who start small businesses. Now, the failure rate of small businesses in the United States is extraordinary. It's within the survival rate for 5 years is somewhere below 35%. So most small businesses fail. The question is, do people who start small businesses know the odds? And it turns out they do not. About 80% of the entrepreneurs estimated that their chances of success were in excess of 70%. Fully one-third believed that their success was certain, that they were sure to succeed. Their estimate for a business like yours, so you have the question, all right, we know about you, but how about generally a business like yours, was 59%, which itself is optimistic. This is an outside view. That outside view is optimistic compared to reality. What we see here is, I believe, that an indication that risk-taking behavior, when we see it, and we see a great deal of it in the marketplace, when we see it, we should quite possibly attribute a great deal of it to overconfidence and to overconfident optimism, rather than assume that people are rational and take risks in full knowledge of the risks that they're taking. It is the blindness of the risks. It is the blindness of risk-taking that explains, I believe, a great deal of what goes on. The biggest puzzle in my mind in this domain is an industry that I've been looking at in several contexts for the last few years, and that's the financial industry, where you have a lot of individuals who are acting in a market that in some sense they believe to be nearly perfect. And yet, everyone there seems to act as if they were above average. That is, everyone seems to believe that they can beat the market. Otherwise, what are they trying to do? You have institutions in the United States, gigantic institutions, which manage the money of very wealthy people. They take in 1% of the wealth that they manage every year. In one firm that we visited, they manage $30 billion. They take in $300 million a year to give, I think, essentially worthless advice, where they advise most people to hold 65% of their wealth in stocks and 35% in bonds. And for that, they take this. They also give specific advice about what stocks to hold, and there they do marginally worse than buying an index fund by about 1%. And that's, you know, this has been going on for years, and it is not an isolated case. And when you talk to these people, this is not fraud. When you talk to these people, they genuinely believe that they can do it. They are a little vague about why they think they can do it better than other people can, but they do believe it, and they are honestly convinced, I'm quite sure, that they are delivering a service that is worth delivering, although, in fact, the data do not support it. So I would conclude that unreasonable optimism is possibly an engine of capitalism, and that we really cannot understand what is going on in the marketplace and in the behavior of investors unless we make that assumption and follow it. And it would seem to me that if that idea were adopted and followed, it ought to have some implications for the analysis of some domains of economic activity. The title that we wrote a paper about this, which I mentioned in the first lecture by Kahneman and Lovello in Management Science in 1993, and we gave it the title of Bold Forecasts and Timid Decisions. And in the first lecture, I spoke about the timid decisions, about the loss aversion. Here, we're speaking about the bold forecast. In combination, what they do is they enable people to take risks with relatively little subjective pain because they do not know the risk that they're taking. Now, there are other manifestations of the focus on the particular. And let me show you a partial list of them. The first one we've already talked about, this is taking the inside view of problems. In general, and that the second one is ignoring base rates and category statistics. The next idea that I'd like to mention is that the focus on the particular means that we tend to think of categories in terms of exemplars. In the United States, there is people who are of a certain age all still remember the enormous political impact of a casual phrase that President Reagan used in describing welfare cases, and he evoked the image of a Cadillac-driving welfare queen. That had enormous impact. That was in people's mind. This person, you know, and people probably added that she had several children out of wedlock, and they all knew she was black, and that he was referring to. And that had a great deal of quite pernicious, I believe, of quite pernicious political impact, just that image. So images, particular instances, vivid images, have very powerful impact on our thinking. Thinking about particular exemplars implies that there is a dimension of many problems that tends to be neglected. Many problems involve thinking about sets or categories. And in many problems, we have to evaluate some characteristic of a set. And there is an old philosophical distinction between the intention, the meaning of a concept, if you will, and the extension or denotation of that concept. There is the intention or meaning is the qualitative aspect, and if there are exemplars, it is the prototypical exemplar would convey the intentional information about a set or category. The size of the category is its extensional dimension. When we think about exemplars, we tend to neglect extension. And it turns out that this is an idea that finds recurrent and very diverse expressions in the way that our mind works. For example, Tversky and I, in the very first research that we did together, investigated a phenomenon that we ironically label the belief in the law of small numbers. And what we observed were that people, including really people who should know better, that is trained statisticians, when they are thinking intuitively, put really unwarranted faith in the evidence of very small samples. That is, you look at the statistic, you look at 80% of people say this and such, and you think that's a large majority, and you may not bother to find out what were the size of the sample of which 80% said this and so. Small samples, the information is held with high subjective confidence. It turns out that when we make predictions about individual cases, the story I told you is a particular example of this, we tend to neglect the base rate. So if we predict an event, it really makes a great deal of difference whether the event is rare or frequent in addition to any particular information that we have about the case. The base rate is always relevant, and it makes a great difference. Research that Tversky and I did a long time ago, and that was followed up by many others, including Griffin with Tversky, showed that there is a very substantial neglect of base rate when people think, not only about their own plans, but even when they're making other predictions. Something I discussed yesterday is another case in which we neglect extension. I described that when we think of episodes, for example, an episode of pain, and my example, I think, was a colonoscopy. So if we think of an episode of pain, that episode has an intentional dimension, which is the experience of given moments. The extensional dimension is duration. And when people look back at episodes of pain and evaluate how bad they were in general, we find the same phenomenon. That is, yet again, we find that they focus on a slice of time, which really is an exemplar, on how painful the colonoscopy was at a representative moment, and yet again, the extensional information is lost. One of Tversky's last students, actually managed to study only for one short year with Tversky, David Featherstone Hall, who is still a student at Stanford, has been studying this phenomenon that we call extension neglect in some quite elegant ways, and I'll show you some of the data that he's collected. Construction workers in the United States are mandated by law to have safety meetings. And so he went to some safety meetings of construction workers around Stanford. And he asked them to fill individual questionnaires where they answered the question, what is the probability that you will suffer an injury? And in some cases, it was next year or in the next 4 years. And those are the numbers, 34 and 43%. That is unreasonable. That is, if the yearly probability, the annual probability is 0.34, then the cumulative probability of suffering at least one injury in over 4 years is certainly more than 43%. Again, the duration has some effect, not quite significant, but I'm sure that that's a real effect. Then he went to some very fancy stores around Stanford and asked a rather cheeky question of people. He approached people and asked them at tax time, what is the probability that the Internal Revenue Service will audit your tax return sometime within the next 2 years or within the next 8 years? And again, we see the same phenomenon. When people think about events and there is a probability, and then you have to adjust by the length of time. And there are obvious adjustments that have to be made. The adjustments that people make are clearly quite inadequate. Here is another application of this. And this is in a domain that has aroused, considerable controversy in the United States in recent years. There is an activity that is called contingent valuation, which is applied to put a value on public goods. And actually, it's a thriving industry in the United States, and there is a great deal of activity in England as well. And in both places, it's a very controversial activity. The general idea is that to put a value on public goods, you survey the population. And you ask the population fundamentally a willingness to pay question. That is, how much would you be willing to pay to ensure provision of that good? And then once you have established in some way the willingness to pay for individual households, you multiply by the number of households, and that is taken to be an estimate of the overall value of that public good. And it's been used in several contexts. It's been proposed to be used in cost-benefit analyses, and it's been used fairly extensively in litigation, and the threat of it has been used in litigation. The major case was a case, the Exxon Valdez case, where people really were asked questions about, you know, the loss that they incurred or how much they would be willing to pay to prevent such a disaster again. That was multiplied by the population of the United States, and then I think the estimate was somewhere like $11 billion was the value, and that was the claim that was put. Now, it turns out that when you ask this question, you find extension neglect. That is, the willingness of people to pay for public goods seem to be very largely independent, or nearly independent, of the amount of the good that will be supplied. I think I actually, with my colleague Jack Nitsch, were one of the very first who ran such a study, where we asked people in Canada how much they would be willing to pay to clean up from acid rain all the lakes in a particular region of Ontario, I think the Muskoka region, and another region of Ontario, the Haliburton region. And then we asked separate samples. These were separate groups. We asked a third group how much they would be willing to pay to clean up all the lakes in Ontario. And the difference that you find in willingness to pay is of the same order as the effects that I've shown you. There is a difference. People are willing to pay a little more when all of Ontario is mentioned than when a small region of Ontario is mentioned, but about 20% more. It feels as if people would be willing to pay almost as much to clean up a single lake as they would be willing to pay to clean up all the lakes. And that is a very powerful example of extension neglect. Here are some more. In a study by McFadden, he found that willingness to pay to provide 57 wilderness areas was 34% higher than willingness to pay to provide one wilderness area. Jones Lee, DeVouge et al. Did a study where separate groups of people expressed willingness to pay to save the lives of birds that otherwise would drown in oil ponds. So this is a realistic scenario. There are oil ponds which migrating birds mistake for water and with terrible results. And so how much would you be willing to pay to cover up those the ponds with nets and to prevent this from occurring? And some people were told that this would save 20,000 birds a year. Others were told that it would save 2 million birds a year. And there is virtually no difference between the amount that people are willing to pay for those public goods. Jones Lee in this country has done many studies of people's willingness to pay, of the value of a life that can be saved. And I think in one of his studies, my notes indicate that willingness to pay was only 20% higher to save 12 lives than to save 4 lives. This, if you stop to think of it, really doesn't make very much sense. And yet, this is the way that people seem to think, and it is a direct consequence, I mean, really a predictable consequence of the type of thinking that I have talked about that involves focusing on exemplars and neglecting extension. Let me bring you one example, a transitional example, on the way between the first theme, which is the power of the popular, and my second, the power of the particular, and my second theme, which is the power of default. When we encounter a particular problem, typically, the problem will evoke its own context of comparison, so that if, in the context of contingent valuation, say, we mention a particular species that has suffered damage, and then people are asked, how important is that problem, or how much would you be willing to pay to take care of that problem? Then people have a response. We call that, psychologists call it, an attitude or an evaluation. And an attitude object is evaluated on its own and relative to a context that it evokes. And if I have mentioned a species, people will think of species. Explicit comparisons to objects from other categories, for example, human problems, can lead to very strange results. Here is a study. people are shown a long list of public affairs problems, and they're asked about each of these problems, their willingness to pay. And here is one. There is a problem and an intervention that's proposed. So skin cancer from sun exposure is common among farm workers. Intervention proposed, support free medical checkups for threatened groups. Somewhere later in the questionnaire, dolphins in the Mediterranean Sea are threatened by pollution. Intervention, contribute to international fund to save the Mediterranean dolphin. Now, when you run that study, there is a rather striking result that emerges, which is that willingness to pay for the dolphin is higher than willingness to pay for workers. And that's, you know, in at least was the case in our sample. It wasn't a large effect, but it was there. Now we take another group of people, and we bring the two problems together, problems that in the first instance had been considered in isolation. We bring the two problems together, and things flip quite dramatically. So when you look at willingness to pay, dolphin, you find that the dolphin is more important for farm workers, for 40 people, farm workers more important than dolphin, or evoke higher willingness to pay for than dolphin for 33. In a choice, people win hands down. Well, you know, not unanimously, but people win. What is happening here? What is happening is another instance in which people think small, in which that major assumption of rationality that I mentioned in the first talk, inclusiveness, is violated in a critical way. People do not evoke the whole context of public goods when they're thinking of a particular public good. They tend to compare it narrowly to the category that it evokes. As a result, they're likely to miss what is turns out to be quite a fundamental aspect of the problem, that these are problems that deal with animal species, and when we are confronted with a comparison that involves the interests of humans and the interests of animals, we generally favor humans. Let me now move on to the second characterization, if you will, or partial characterization of bounded rationality with which I plan to describe today. And for the next 20 minutes or so, I'll talk about default actions and reference outcomes. Let me start with an example, which is, I think, fairly striking in its implications. It turns out that both in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, a law was passed not very long ago, and in fact, the law was passed virtually simultaneously in both states, which allows people or forces insurance, compels insurance companies to offer a cheaper insurance rate for people who accept limitations on their right to sue. So because litigation is very expensive, there is a law that allows people to bind themselves, limits their litigation rights, and in exchange, they pay less. They pay a lower rate for insurance. Now, in New Jersey, the state in which I live, the limited right to sue is the default option. So as you see the form, you have to check if you want the full right to sue. So you have just to make a check mark. That's all you have to do. But unless you check it, the default option is presented as the limited right to sue. In Pennsylvania, it turns out, it's different. And the story is told, I'm not sure that it's authoritative, but the story is told that the tort lawyers managed to change the rule in committee at the very last minute before the regulation was passed, and they managed to arrange that the default option is the full right to sue. And now you are checking a box, a special box, if you want the limited right to sue. Now, a rational agent should not be affected by this variation of format. But the preference for limited rights is 70% in New Jersey and 16% in Pennsylvania. And to the best that we can trace it, this is the reason that this occurred. So, and the difference is consequential for individual motorists. The annual cost to Pennsylvania drivers is estimated to be $200 million. This is not a small object. What we find is that designating an option as a default option has enormous power in controlling people's behavior. And it's a powerful instrument of social control and, I think, of social policy. There are many things that can be done. For example, by removing parts of people's income in a way, you know, this can, the taxation that people pay can be made very obvious, or it can be hidden. In the United States, for example, and this is, I'm sure, not an accident, every tax is made very obvious. And this is because, you know, in the United States, the attitude to taxes is extremely hostile. And this is expressed in every way. Here is another case where designating an option as a default option is absolutely critical. I'm currently involved in a peripheral way with a group that is asking itself a question of how to advise people about the allocation of their retirement money, a part of their retirement money, which is going to be privately controlled, which may be a very bad idea altogether, I'm afraid, but that's the law. It's going to be controlled by individuals. And the question is, how should they be advised? Turns out there is certainly a critical decision, and we're all aware of it in the group that's working on it. The critical decision is a default case. It is an individual is going to come and key in age, income, and number of relatives, liabilities, etc., I mean, a few other details, and then a number will pop up on the screen, and then that individual will have the option of taking more risk, taking less risk, adjusting this, adjusting that, saving more, saving less. I mean, there'll be a lot of decisions. But where we start, where the default case for that individual starts, is going to determine the fate of the program. We expect that most people will not even bother to go beyond the default case. Now, in a fully rational individual, you know, you would casually assume, in a theory that assumes the rationality of agent making important decisions, would casually assume that a variable like that should have no effect. But in fact, I think it is very worthwhile, both for instruments, both to watch against social control that can be insidious, or possibly, if anybody here wants to be benevolent about it, you are going to be able to do a great deal in life by determining which option is a default option and which option changes. Here is another example. Default allocations to pension funds. My friend Richard Thaler, whom I've quoted a lot here, says that in the United States, this is really one of the most important decisions that people will make in their lives. It doesn't quite rank as getting married or not, but it's when people enroll in a retirement plan, for example, a young professor taking his or her first position, would enroll in a retirement plan and would be asked to allocate their pension monies among several funds that vary in the amount of risk that they take. And this is the basic finding. A TWA offers six funds, and people have to allocate 100% of their retirement money among their six funds. Five of them are in stocks, and one is a bond fund, which is more conservative. The amount that people hold in stocks in TWA is 74%. The University of California offers two funds, one stock fund, one equity fund, and the holdings are 34% in stocks. The modal allocation to funds is 1 over N, where N is the number of funds that are allowed. That is the default option, and is a very powerful default option indeed. The default option is just allocate things equally among the possibilities. And it turns out that in decisions that are very consequential, people do this. Now, why do we have this? And what else do we know about it? There is a label that I would like to associate with at least some of these results. Samuelson and Zeckhauser, in an important and very interesting paper in 1988, talked about the status quo bias. And the status quo bias is that when one of the options is to do nothing, that is automatically the default option. So the default option is do nothing, is omission rather than commission. And in many experiments and in field studies, they were able to show a massive status quo bias. Again, for example, in the choice of health plans. Every year in every university in the United States, there is a week during which it's open enrollment. People have to decide which health plan they're going to adopt. It turns out people, by and large, just don't change health plans. This is an important decision. Health plans keep coming up so that new plans become available. The new plans tend to be adopted largely by new people who come into the institution. The other people who are staying in the institution just by and large do not move. The amount of changes, the rate at which people change their allocations is about 3% a year who actually make a change in their choice of health plan. This is a very important decision. People obviously make that decision by and large by simply staying with the default. Now, why would that be the case? Here, I'm going to bring in a little bit of emotion after all. It turns out that there are important differences at the emotional and in some cases, as we'll see in a few minutes, at the moral level, between omission and commission, between maintaining the status quo and actually doing something. Here is an example. Mr. Paul owned shares in Company A. During the past year, he considered switching to stock in Company B, but he decided against it. He now finds that he would have been better off by $20,000 if he had switched to Company B. Mr. George owned shares in Company B. During the past year, he switched to stock in Company A. He now finds that he would have been better off by $20,000 if he had kept the stock of Company B. Who is more upset? This turns out to be a very easy question. There is 97% agreement as to who of these two people is more upset. And the one who is more upset is the one who actually made a change, the one who considered making a change but didn't. That is, the one who stayed with a default option is expected to suffer a great deal less regret. Now, if this is indeed the case, that is, if there is that asymmetry between regrets of commission and regrets of omission, and we have massive evidence that there is such an asymmetry, we are going to find a powerful force for inertia that, again, has very little place in a rational model of decision-making. In a rational analysis of decision, there is no such asymmetry, and everything that I'm saying about default options is really not represented for a rational agent. Deciding to do nothing is just the same as deciding to do something. We can explain omission by people economizing on their thinking and so on, but when people consider an option, after considering an option, it is a little hard to discuss, to explain. I should say, however, not everybody is like that. Default choices reduce regrets, and that's true for the majority of people. But we have, and again, with my friend Dick Thaler, we have stumbled on a result that indicates that there are important individual differences and that not everybody acts in that way. We had access and were able to obtain interviews with 120 very wealthy people. I mean, the poorest in that group had wealth of $6 million, and the richest something like $400 million. And so, you know, they varied a lot. And we were interested, although all of them, I think, got essentially the same advice, as I mentioned, to have 65% in stocks. In fact, there was a fair amount of variety among them in the amount of risk that they were taking. It turns out that when the best predictors of the risk that people are willing to take are not the standard economic variables. They're not age, and they're not wealth, and they're not current expenditure. So all the economic variables did not turn out significant in the multiple regression when we ran it. The variables that did turn up as predicted were answers to questions about regret and optimism. It turns out that people who invest a lot in stocks describe themselves as, when asked about a decision that they're proud of, it's always a decision, almost always a decision to do something and not a decision to refrain from doing. When they're asked about a decision that they regret, it's they regret things they didn't do and not things that they did do. When they're asked about the role of chance in the outcomes that they encountered in the decision that ended well for them and in a decision that had a bad outcome, investors who are high in the proportion of stocks that they hold tend to say that luck had very little to do with it. And they tend to say that both about decisions that turned out well and about decisions that turned out poorly. Psychologists would say that the investors who are high in stocks suffer from an illusion which is labeled the illusion of control. They think they can control their fate. It makes them optimistic. Most of us have the illusion of control, and most of us are overly optimistic, but some people are more than others, and those who are more than others, prone to optimism and prone to regrets of omission rather than to regrets of commission, turn out to be the risk takers among us. Here's another example where we are now moving into the moral arena. In the state you live in, there had been several epidemics of a certain kind of flu, which can be fatal to children under 3. 10 of every 10,000 children will die from the flu. A vaccine for this kind of flu has been developed and tested. The vaccine eliminates the probability of getting the flu. The vaccine, however, might cause side effects that are also sometimes fatal. Now, the question that people are asked, and this was asked both of students and also of parents, actually, who were trying to imagine a realistic situation. So what would you do? Would you vaccinate the child? And if you were in charge of public health, would you support such a program? That is, at what death rate from the vaccine would you not have a vaccine? If people were fully consequentialist, that is, if one death is just about as bad as another, then there would be no reason to discriminate, so that up to 10 deaths from the vaccine, you're still saving some lives. The average turns out to be about 5, and it turns out in subsequent studies on this problem, when people in fact are in charge and responsible, the costs of making that choice are very, very high. So if a child dies from an untreated type of flu, this is an act of God. But if the child dies of side effects from the vaccine, this looks completely different. Accountability enhances this effect. And a famous decision analyst, Ron Howard, discussed that in connection with the behavior of public officials. His example was the example of whether to seed hurricanes. It turns out he thought that hurricanes should be seeded. They shouldn't be seeded. But he noted that even if decision analysis would favor the seeding of hurricane, very likely the political system would not adopt it. Because a seeded hurricane might then suddenly change course and hit Miami, and everybody would be sure that it was the fault of the seeding, and therefore they would assume that whoever intervened in, you know, the God-given weather, whoever intervened was actually responsible for the outcome. Ron Howard called that the responsibility cost, which is associated, notice, with commission, with an act, with acting, not with refraining from acting. He called it a form of embezzlement. More defaults, and I do not have many more. Goals turn out to be defaults with consequences that are puzzling in terms of economic theory. A goal might be defined in terms that now will look familiar because we share the concept of loss aversion. A goal might be defined as an outcome that people will work harder to reach than to exceed. That is, if people work just as hard to exceed the goal as to reach it, it wouldn't be a goal. So it's that definition of behavior around the goal, that it's important to reach it, that defines what a goal is. Well, a group of colleagues and friends, Colin Kammerer and several others, had a clever idea, which is to look at the effect of goal-directed behavior among cab drivers in New York. Now, there are good days for cab drivers and bad days for cab drivers. A good day for a cab driver is when there is a big convention in town, especially of wealthy people, not an academic convention, and a good day for cab drivers is when it rains. Now, cab drivers regulate their own labor supply. They determine when they go home. And so you can look at when do cab drivers quit. Now, rational behavior is absolutely clear that a cab driver should drive long hours on good days and short hours on bad days. And that much should be obvious. It turns out this is not what you observe. What you observe is that cab drivers work short hours on good days and long hours on bad days. What they're working for is an income goal. And because they're working for that income goal, the economic consequences in terms of labor supply are distinctly paradoxical. So this, again, is a default, the default behavior. You work towards some objective, and this is what it does to you. Now, it turns out that defaults have moral power. That is, defaults define informal entitlements, which in the normal run of things are defended by the people who feel they have that entitlement and are respected by most others. So those are outcomes that people come to view as their right because they're default outcomes. And they're defended by indignation. People will punish if they can. But they're often respected even in the absence of any enforcement. Here's an example. Unenforced tipping. Now, people... I've had that conversation actually with some economist friends, and I think that at least one of them lied to me because he said that he wouldn't tip in a restaurant that he wouldn't visit again. I'm sure he was lying to me. People just don't do that. People, it turns out, tip about the same amount in a restaurant that they visit regularly and in a restaurant that they never intend to visit again. This is unenforced behavior, but there is a default behavior. It's purely conventional. It's unenforced and unenforceable and very widely respected. Here is a default in a very famous game that... the ultimatum game, where the situation is that an amount of money is made available to a pair of players, and one of the players is given control over the money and determines an allocation. So you have the controller is given, say £100, and then you have the other player. And the controller is to determine an amount of money, an allocation between himself or herself and the other player. The other player has an option of accepting the offer or rejecting it. If the second player rejects the offer, neither of them gets anything. So that the power of the second player is entirely to punish the first player at some cost to him or herself. Now, economic theory is unequivocal about what should happen in this situation. And what should happen is that the first player ought to offer the second player a penny, and the second player ought to accept it, because a penny is better than nothing. So this is not at all the behavior that is observed. The behavior that is observed is that the modal allocation, the most frequent allocation, is 50%. Furthermore, people who do not get an adequate amount of compensation frequently reject offers. Now, this was discovered by Guth, a German economist, in 1982. I must confess that one of the sad things in my life is that we discovered it too a few years later, but then when we were writing the paper, we found that he had already published it. Allocations tend to be mostly fair, and a lot of unfair allocations are simply rejected. Now, at first, it was thought that this behavior would vanish when the stakes got really high, but it turns out it doesn't vanish when the stakes are really high. This game has now been played for 2 or 3 month income. You know, you take $100 to Indonesia, say, and you can, $100 will go a very long way, and the behavior is very much the same. In fact, if anything, there is a slight trend that people make more 50-50 offers when the stakes are very high because they are so afraid of, you know, meeting a mad person who will punish them both and reject any offer that is less than 50-50. So people are willing to pay a great deal to defend something that is perceived as a default, basically. Reciprocation, tit-for-tat behavior, all of these tend to be default actions that people defend and people respect. In the world of business, it turns out there are rules about what is considered fair and what is considered unfair, or at least there are rules that, I will be specific because I'm not sure, you know, there are no cultural universals here. This was true in Canada some 15 years ago when we did a study. I think some of it is probably still true, 12 years ago. We studied what are the views of the public about what is considered fair or unfair practice for a business. And we ended up with a model that is a very simple model that we call the dual entitlement model, which says that there is a reference transaction. That is, people have a normal wage. that they have enjoyed. This is attached to an individual. An individual has a wage that he or she has been receiving from an employer. And whether this is formal or informal, this sets up an expectation. It's a reference transaction. There is a given price at which goods are sold. Now, there are reasons that are good reasons, say, for the firm to change the price or change the wage. That is, the firm can break the reference transaction. And it turns out people have very strong views about when it is permissible for a firm to make a move that violates the reference transaction. The reference transaction allows entitlements both to the firm and to the individuals that it interacts with. The firm is entitled to its profit. The individuals are entitled to their wage or to their price. Here is an example. Pricing a scarce automobile model. I dropped a word here. It turns out that if the story is told that a model of a car has now become very scarce, and now we ask people, is it fair for the firm to eliminate a discount that it had been offering? People feel that, yes, it is fair, by and large, to eliminate a discount, or at least the proportion will say it's unfair, is less than 50%. Is it all right to add a surcharge to a scarce car? Now, economically, that should not make a difference. It does make a difference to the moral attitude of people. That is, there is a reference transaction, and you're supposed to stick to it. You cannot unilaterally impose a loss on the other side just in order to achieve a gain. A firm whose profits have stopped rising, still profitable, its profits have stopped rising, could it eliminate a bonus that it had been paying its employees? Only 20% in that sample thought that was unfair. Could it reduce wages because its profits had stopped rising? 62% thought that was unfair. A profitable firm with much unemployment, can it exploit its market power to cut the wages of employees because it could easily replace them at a lower wage? 77% of people consider that this is unfair. A firm that has been losing money, at least in that Canadian sample, it was considered fair, or at least a majority of people considered it acceptable. It was not considered unfair for a firm that has been losing money to cut wages. What do all these examples tell us? An existing situation, a status quo, gets endowed with multiple powers. As a default option, we tend to choose it. As a default option, it may define entitlements that people will defend and that people will respect. Changes in the entitlements of others, especially if they are motivated by gains, by wishing to increase your own gains, are unacceptable. It is all right to change the entitlements of others in order to protect yourself, at least according to these rules. There is a very elaborate setup system of rules that govern how we act in respect to defaults. So let me conclude. I'm done with what I was going to say. And I'd like to mention some of the themes that have been, you know, that I've talked about in all three of these lectures. I spoke of the characteristics of the agent. We spoke of many aspects of bounded rationality. Bounded rationality is Herbert Simon's term, and you can see a lot of what we've been doing as an attempt to develop a program that he outlined in the 1950s with that notion of bounded rationality. Didn't develop it in quite the way he had in mind, but that was basically his idea. So we've seen an optimistic bias, we've seen susceptibility to framing, we've seen a strong bias toward default options, we've seen, we haven't seen money illusion because I ran out of time, but we could have seen money illusion. The individual also has bounded self-control. That's a phrase of Richard Thaler that I like, and bounded selfishness. So in many ways we have, we have modified some of the standard assumptions, and we have certainly seen in the lecture yesterday that the individual has evolving tastes. Now, a question that I'm not going to answer, I'm just going to raise, are all these ideas useful to economists? I came as a psychologist, and I told you that I would mostly stick to what I know, and the question of whether anything can be done by economists using this material is not a question really that is for me to answer. I would suggest that the time may have come to some extent to shift the burden of proof. That is, at the moment, the burden of proof for demonstrating violations of rationality or violations of selfishness or violations of unchanging taste, the burden of proof lies exclusively on the critic. If you're a psychologist trying to talk to economists, you've really got to go through many, many hoops in order to show them something that is intuitively obvious to anybody, actually, so that common sense becomes something the burden of proof is on common sense. And I would make a plea for shifting some of the burden of proof, or perhaps being a little more willing than, you know, for not demanding so much, because it seems to me if some of these ideas can usefully be applied, then it would indeed, then applying them in the context in which you also have to have unequivocal demonstration that there is no rational explanation or no selfish explanation for the behavior that you observe seems to me to be just a little bit too much. And the final sentence that was on this was that it seems to me that the way that those ideas, if at all, will be exploited in economic reasoning will not be that people will just change the model completely. This is just not going to happen. But maybe in building specific models and continuing to function as economists, it is possible to introduce one or two of these slightly more realistic assumptions, complicating the model somewhere to some degree, and yet doing reasonable economics in the standard way. And thank you very much for your patience.
Well, thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. We have time for some questions or brief comment. Who would like to start?
Your example about the discount and the surcharge suggested another very relevant example. We have our budget next Tuesday, and I'd like to know whether you've done any experiments on offering people exactly the same monetary change
I do not know of direct evidence, but I think you can really assume that this is the case, because there is massive evidence of very similar asymmetries. And so if one of these is defined, the word discount, actually the very first demonstration of this was again by Richard Thaler, whom I'm quoting maybe too much, in a lovely paper that he wrote in 1980 on positive theory of the consumer. He talked of the difference which existed at the time in the United States between the two prices that you could pay at a gas station, the cash price and the credit price. And there were two possibilities of labeling it. You could label it a cash discount, or you could label it a credit card surcharge. And the question was, which of these two wordings would the credit card industry require? And of course you can tell that the credit card industry really did not want to be labeled as a credit card surcharge. They wanted it to be labeled as a discount, as a cash discount, because a discount is a foregone gain. And if you remember that the value function is much less steep for gains than for losses, you would really confidently predict that difference. So I'm quite sure that that would be true for taxes as well.
Is it possible that ascribing the rationality may contribute to social rationality, rather like ants dying for the sake of the colony? The practice of refusing unfair bargains may lead to a social situation where everyone is.
Oh, absolutely. It's been observed in many of these games, for example, in many games that involve cooperation or that require cooperation, there have been several studies recently comparing how economists fare in these games to how other people fare in these games. And where tacit cooperation and the assumption of trust is involved, economists tend to do rather poorly compared to other people. And those who have had a course in game theory tend to do especially badly, actually. I think that's an excellent question, and I do not know the answer. I do not think that the idea of competing frames, I've heard it expressed, you know, in that context, and I've often been curious about it myself, but I haven't studied it, and I don't know of anyone else who has. I'm quite sure you're right that they, you know, that a lot of this isn't new. Certainly, the surcharge discount, you know, is not that's not very deep, and many of the other examples. Whether, well, you know, 25 years ago I tried to have a curriculum for high schools, and that didn't work very well. So I'm not absolutely sure of, you know, how much can be accomplished through education. But warning people about the rhetoric of politics, teaching people to discern frames, teaching people how to be critical, teaching people about the possibility of trying to reframe an argument, that is, of seeing whether the argument survives if you find another way of describing the outcome, would seem to me to be a worthwhile exercise. I do not think, and that question I think came up after my first lecture, I do not think that we can educate intuitions very well. That is, I'm not terribly optimistic that by teaching people will make them spontaneously able to see a problem in more than one way. This will always take effort. But by teaching people, you might alert them that when a problem is genuinely important, it might be worthwhile reframing. And an example I gave was that if it's a big financial problem, thinking of it in terms of wealth rather than in terms of gains and losses may really be worth doing. So it's effortful, it's not the intuitively obvious way of doing it, but one might perhaps achieve something by teaching people how to reframe. Yes. Oh. I think I agree with what you said, so I have very little by way of response. I simply agree with it. There is very little reason to view selfishness as rational. This, you know, this is just part of the bundle of the way that those assumptions have come bundled up in economic theory. And what was common to all the examples I described were that none of them was predicted by standard economic theory. Some of them, you put a value judgment that they appear stupid, others appear socially cooperative, but what they all have in common is that they're not part of the standard theory. Yes?
When you talked about the book example, writing this textbook, and it didn't work, the first thing that flashed in my head was when I started my degree at Oxford, kept graduating from the this is supposed to take 3 years, but 40% of people never get it, and only about 20% of people finish on time. And I was just wondering, I mean, given those statistics, would you say it's ever rational to pursue this? Rational. I mean, I was trying to think what would actually counterbalance it, but I mean, obviously some people do make it. I mean, it's not, there's a more of a, you know, a normal curve in the book example where everybody doesn't finish in 7 to 10 years.
Well, you know.
It's very hard to advise people. I mean, they're all admitted. They all presumably were capable in some way. How are you supposed to apply that kind of knowledge to any individual?
the point I made about our book not being worth doing applied to our book. It did not necessarily apply to Oxford DPhil, which may be worth acquiring. It probably is worth acquiring. So not every project is worthless. What I was proposing was that many projects are undertaken in ignorance of their real chance for success, and that that is an essential part of the picture of why they're chosen.
But given that this speech had been made years and years and years, and nobody had ever taken this exercise frame, was it useful to even tell them?
Well, if
I don't think anybody quit after
that. That is really the question I was going to ask you. If it deterred someone or made it easier for them to give up, even if they did not quit immediately, knowing that many people quit might have made them quit, more of them quit after the first year if it was unsatisfactory, and then I think it would be all to the good. So giving that outside frame, I think, would be very useful. In philosophy, in the United States, very few philosophy PhDs ever get a job in philosophy. And now some philosophy departments are requiring their students that they enter to sign a declaration that they know they're very unlikely to get a job as professional philosophers. So that there's an informed consent declaration that, you know, we know this is not about getting a job. This is just about getting a doctorate. Yes? You're assuming that their behavior is budget constrained, that is, that they are paying.
If they take it seriously, they have to think about their
personal but
budget.
It turns out there is a lot of evidence that the behavior is not budget constrained. In the first place, it's the sums, the insensitivity applies to sums that are so small relative to income that it's very unlikely that there are significant income effects, you know, that are determining the results. So people have looked at that. There have been Peter Diamond in particular has actually collected data on and analyzed the theory for this. There is a property in willingness to pay that's called the add-up property. That is that, you know, if you're going to have two wilderness areas, you could in some ways figure out how much you ought to be willing to pay for the second, or for both of them, or for the second if the first one has been provided by someone else for free. So those experiments have been run, and using those experiments, it's unequivocal that this is not a budget constraint, that the result is not due to a budget constraint, but really to insensitivity to extension. I do not know, but this is my ignorance. I do not know of many studies documenting large differences, large gender differences or cultural differences. There have been studies of the ultimatum game in different cultures, and you know there are differences, and people have written about the differences. Al Roth has conducted a comparative studies in six nations. One is, I would say, what is more impressive are the commonalities than the difference. And my impression is that that was also the conclusion of a lot of research that was done on the prisoner's dilemma, studying gender differences. There were some gender differences, but the important trends in general were common. I do not know. There are differences. There are certainly cultural differences in attitudes to risk and to gambling and to probability. And there is now a fair amount of research being done in China, but I do not know the results. So this is a field that either is not developed or is developed, and I don't know it. I have a slide I didn't show, if I can find it. In our study about fairness, we presented people with the following problem. A company is making a small profit. It is located in a community experiencing a recession with substantial unemployment but no inflation. There are many workers anxious to work at the company. The company decides to decrease wages and salary 7% this year. Is this fair or unfair? And this is considered unfair. Exactly the same problem, where there is with substantial unemployment and inflation of 12%. The company decides to increase salaries only 5% this year, and only 22% believe that this is unfair. Now, the net effect on the workers is obviously the same. The attribution is different. It is very much like the act of God So it turns out that the default or the reference transaction is denominated in nominal terms and not in real terms. So people's entitlements are in nominal terms, and there have been some studies, with real income and so on. Things do happen to people's wages during inflation that do not normally happen. In academic departments, for example, in the United States, cutting wages is unheard of. It would be easier to fire someone, and it's almost impossible to fire anyone, but it would be easier to fire someone than to cut their wages. But not raising wages during periods of high inflation, and there was a period of high inflation, and there are people who have never recovered from their wages not being raised during 4 or 5 years where inflation, where other people were getting 10, 15, 20% increases. So that rule seems to be obeyed in the marketplace. And clearly, there is money illusion built into it.
Well, last one.
Could I just ask, how can we get hold of a written version of these talks?
OK, well, that enables me to to say my piece. There will be a version of these transparencies available from my secretary, who you could ring on 955-7048, extension 7048. I imagine after a few days. But
She already has it.
So either go around or ring, and she will send it to you. And there will, of course, be a book published by MIT Press in due course. I think these have been some of the most important lectures that I've ever been to, and certainly some of the most important Robbins lectures that we've had, because they go really to the heart of economics. I think that the older one is, the more aware one becomes of the lack of interest which all non-economists have in our subject and the general disrepute in which it is held. And I think, I genuinely think that most economists can't understand why the subject is looked on so unfavorably by so many people, especially maybe politicians. And the reason is quite simply that they do overlook absolutely basic aspects of human nature, which are taken into account by any politician or businessman who actually has to operate in the world where real people are living. Some of this is, of course, unfortunate. This is what the question is we're getting at. I mean, how much of it should we accept of human nature, and how much should we think, well, this is ridiculous? Now, I mean, you pointed to the problem that people are stupid when they evaluate their colonoscopy. They just don't know how bad it was, and they would make a bad choice the next time. which while they were having it, they would regret, though afterwards they might not. So, I mean, you were saying yourself that some of these things are deeply regrettable. I remember vividly, in I think it must have been 1973, when there was a lot of pressure being brought on Heath, who was the Prime Minister, to raise pensions by even, you know, a pound or two. A week, he said he couldn't, there was no question of doing this. Instead, he gave them a Christmas bonus of, I think, £10. This was greeted with absolute acclaim, and I remember vividly canvassing in a very working class area a nurse who said she had never voted Conservative in her life, but this act of supreme generosity, £10, which was spread over a year, about, I don't know what it was, 20p a week or something, some wretched sum, showed how he really cared about the pensioners, which, of course, is pure trickery. So people are stupid, and it's understandable that economists don't like this, and they don't feel that they should debase their activities by recommending politicians to do this sort of thing. I think that that is in a way, quite reasonable. I mean, somebody else can do that bit of it. But I think there are more basic things, like this loss aversion. I mean, the fact that taking money away from people is not a continuous function in which maybe there's diminishing marginal utility, and if you take away a lot, it hurts them more than if you gave them the same amount would benefit them. It's that there is a kink, there is a complete dichotomy between the way that gains and losses are perceived. Politics is deeply embedded into the minds of politicians and businessmen. It is overlooked in all economics. And these kind of things bring the subject into deep disrepute when people are actually doing, making policy recommendations on the basis of models which do not correspond in any way to the fundamentals of human nature. And there's no reason we should want to change those fundamentals. Those fundamentals may be the reasons why human beings have survived on this earth, that they adapt and they then like to have stability, and they generate, they organize their lives to promote that kind of stability. This needs to be recognized. Now, this does, as you hinted very delicately at the end, require some fundamental reconstruction of our subject. And that's why I think that the book which comes from these lectures, which perhaps makes available to economists in a more user-friendly fashion and in a more orderly fashion, material which has, of course, been available in bits and pieces in the academic journals for many years, this should make a real challenge to our profession to face up to these facts of human nature. So I think, and I'm sure I'm speaking for all the other Lionel Robbins Memorial Trust trustees, that we made a wonderful choice in asking you to come. It's not only the matter that you brought us, which has been so important, but the manner in which you've brought it, which has been really lovely. And we really enjoyed it and appreciated it. And thank you very, very much.
Thank you.